It's ad break time. Beyond Solitaire is proudly sponsored by Central Michigan University's Center for Learning through Games and Simulations. And as usual, they are cooking up some exciting things in the educational gaming space. Cartini, From Darkness to Light, designed by Sharia Iwandini and published by Ion Game Design, is coming to Kickstarter on June 6th and will feature a curriculum guide written as part of a partnership between Ion and CLGS. Rising Waters, the second game from CLGS, will be fulfilling soon, and you should keep your eyes peeled for updates on the launch of their next release, 500-Year-Old Vampire. I also want to put in a word for myself. If you like this podcast and want to help me do more projects related to history and gaming, please go to patreon.com/beyondsolitaire to support my channel. For now, though, let's get on with the show. Hey, gamers, it's Liz Davidson from Beyond Solitaire, and I'm here this week with a very special guest. This is Stefan Aguirre Quiroga. He is a PhD student in history at Gothenburg in Sweden. So we are up at very different times, but here to talk about a common cause. How you doing, Stefan?
I'm doing very good. How are you?
I'm great. I'm so happy to have you on. So for those of you out there, I have had Stefan on because he wrote a really, really interesting book called White Mythic Space. And it is a study of Battlefield 1 and perceptions of historical accuracy when it concerns soldiers of color in the war. Would you say that's about right, Stefan?
Yes, that's absolutely what I'm. What the whole book is about. You're very, very well.
But the main thing I want to start us by talking about is historical memory, because I think it's the foundation for the rest of this conversation. So, Stefan, what is the most accessible possible version that we can get of historical memory so that we can all kind of latch on to this conversation?
All right. So I would always start by saying that there are sort of three understandings about the past. One is the past itself, which is everything that has ever happened. And, you know, like when you got up this morning, or when I fed my cat, or when your grandmother baked a pie many, many years ago. That's the past. You can't change that. It is what it is. And then there's history, that's what first are going to make people take a step back, because history is the academic pursuit or the professional study of the past. So that is what historians, academics, scholars, everything, that's how they interpret all that stuff that already happened in the past. So that's two, past, history, and then there's historical memory. And historical memory is not history. Historical memory is the way people, groups, sometimes entire nations, sometimes just a small little hobby group, how they interpret and remember the past, and how they then choose to represent it in their own specific way. And this can be everything from, you know, political uses of history to sort of make a political point. You may hear that a lot in speeches, to representations of the past in films or television series, or in this specific case, video games.
So just to kind of belabor the point, historical memory would be something like, you know, oh, we have a national identity where this is our, this is what we're about, and here's our national character, and we can pull it out of history. So as opposed to, you know, this is what happened, or like, let's do a study of the movements that intersected in order to lead to this event. It's something that's a little bit more personal in a lot of cases.
It's more personal. It's more, sometimes it's that history that is used to unify an entire people, or to create an image of what a group is all about, it's sort of to legitimize them, or sort of push their history, their past further back to the point where it's sort of like, well, these people wouldn't really consider themselves belong to this group. Let's say I'm from Scandinavia, so Vikings, for example, they wouldn't have considered themselves Swedes or Norwegians. They would have considered them something completely different. But Norwegians and Swedes still considered Vikings to be part of their history as something that is theirs. And that's where you get sort of these specific ideas. And then there are specific ideas tied to historical memory, like that are invented much later. Sort of Vikings had horns on their helmets. That's a very, very popular idea about Vikings, which, you know, today we know that's wrong. That was invented in the late 19th century. But for a very long time, that was sort of seen as the stereotypical image of what a Viking is. And that's historical memory.
Yeah, actually, one of the discussions I liked about it a lot in your book was the discussion of Westerns, like the idea of the Wild West and like the untamed West, and how do people dress and how do people act out in the West, and how much of that is just kind of dime novel myth as opposed to how things actually worked. And yet it's so pervasive. You know, when we think of a Western, there's a really specific set of tropes that may not really be that Western at all. And it's, you know, I remember learning in grad school, I had to do a reading German class. We had an entire set of chapters about how much Germans like Westerns.
Absolutely. And Swedes do too. There's a big theme park, Western theme park in Sweden called High Chaparral, named after the famous TV show. And it's, I loved it when I was a kid, and I still love going there. But it's sort of weird as to how pervasive this historical memory about the West, which is communicated through first dime novels and then later Wild West shows and ultimately Westerns, the actual films and TV shows, and how this has created what actual theories would call a historical consciousness about the Wild West, where they sort of know how to connect their own present to that past as something that's actually happened. And you know, it always sucks to have to explain people that the Wild West never existed, that, you know, the whole gunfight, the whole that thing is just never did. That's just fiction. But that often gives, I'm often like, oh, but you know, there's a very interesting history here that you can explore that you'll find. But yeah, the Western, the Wild West, it's a great example of a historical memory that is so, so strong.
Yes. And like, there are a lot more that we can talk about, but I do want to get to how this applies to gaming. So you decided to focus your study of historical memory on Battlefield 1. What led you to do that? And just give people a primer on what Battlefield 1 is, because it's a video game, not a board game. So I don't know who knows.
Exactly. So Battlefield 1 is, it was a first-person shooter. So one of them shooting games that was set during the First World War. And that made it very unique, because this was one of the very, very, at the time, very, very few games that was actually set during the First World War. And it was released to the PlayStation, to the Xbox, to the PC in 2016, in the fall of 2016. So 2016, sort of, to put this in even a wider context, is that it was released during the First World War centenary. So 100 years had passed since the First World War. So the period between 2014 and 2018, we got a lot of new media concerning the First World War. Battlefield 1 was one of them. And it was a very highly critically acclaimed game. I loved playing it. And I think that's what sort of led me into studying it, because I noticed in online discussions, I'm a historian and I'm a PhD student in the University of Gothenburg, but even back then, obviously, I was very interested in history. And I had a specific interest in the lives and experience of these smaller nations and colonies during the First World War, and particularly those that involved racialized minorities. So at the time, I already had an interest in it. I had read scholarship and stuff like that. So I noticed that the online discourse was incredibly polarized because of the inclusion of soldiers of color in the game. One of the first views that we got about the game was they leaked the sort of cover of the game, which shows an African American soldier, and that blew people's minds to have a historic depiction of a black man on a video game that wasn't necessarily negative, first of all. And second, having someone tied to history, particularly the First World War, and that made a lot of people upset. A lot of were positive, but a lot of people were upset. And this sort of, I noticed this, and I found it very fascinating. So I started following it and realized that it only got worse over time as the game was released, to the point where even today it's still, I mean, it's almost, what can it be, 6-7 years ago? God, time moves fast.
Yeah.
people still reference it as something negative, this inclusion of people of color in Battlefield 1, to the point where it's sort of almost like a something you use to make fun of DICE and Electronic Arts, which were the production companies and the publisher of the game. So I got caught in it because I thought it was an interesting phenomenon that went against, because for the first time, this game tried to do something historically accurate, and suddenly people flipped out because it was.
Yeah, and one thing I thought was very interesting is that, you know, as you say, it was, in fact, extremely historically accurate to include soldiers of color in basically all of the armies of World War One. We're talking about colonial powers who drafted soldiers from all over the place. It was a world war. And yet there's something about that that challenges people's sense of authenticity. It actually reminds me of a conversation I had with Kate Cook about women in classical video games. Like, there's a difference between what's accurate and what people perceive as authentic. Mm-hmm. So would you say that that kind of attaches to what you're running into with this?
Yes, because when I obviously proposed these ideas that I have, the because I was wondering, why are people so upset about the inclusion of people of color in this video game? You know, the basic answer is, well, they're racist. And, you know, yeah, they are. But there's more to it than that. There's an understanding about the past that escapes them in a bit. And why is it that even when presented with proof, with evidence of the complete opposite, that they are wrong, they completely persist in trying to minimize or even erase these people of color. And on the one hand, there is obviously historical ignorance. There's a lack of understanding that during the First World War, the Western Front in Europe between 1914 and 1918 was essentially the most multicultural, multiracial place on earth, where you had soldiers from across the world, from, you know, obscure islands in the Pacific, through the indigenous people of the Americas, through soldiers from French Indochina, from all over the world, again, fighting for the colonial powers. Because that's what makes the war a world war. You know, it doesn't, because a lot of people do notice that from both ends, which I've also heard, you know, why should we care about the First War? It was a white man's war. It was just these white guys fighting against each other. And so I think it goes sort of both ways in a way, but it's sort of like this very specific version of the First World War that is still propagated. So on one hand, there's that history that not a lot of people know. And then there's an additional layer in which it is the interconnecting worlds that we're talking about, because it's not only the colonial soldiers that I speak about in the book, it is also the people who are already living in these European countries who are not of European ancestry. And that made a lot of people upset because, number one, they think, well, okay, there were people of color in this war, but they were all segregated. When truth is, beyond the United States Army, there was forms of integration in all of these European armies. So Great Britain, for example, did not have any specific laws against integrating people of color into their armies. So people of color could easily serve in all white British regiments. The same thing applies to the Imperial German Army, you know, the French Army, and so on, so on. And the people who did serve in these armies who were people of color were usually men who had lived in these countries for generations. So these are people who consider themselves British, for example, whose parents might have settled, or grandparents or great-grandparents might have ended up in Great Britain generations ago. And that tells a completely different story that made a lot of people uncomfortable, because it does speak to legacies about colonialism, for example, or the, you know, transatlantic slavery. So usually these are involved very, very complicated stories that for a lot of people also goes against the very image that they have of their country, of being a multiracial, multicultural country. And I see that a lot with Europeans in particular, because the Europeans usually see the United States as being a racialized country. As one of the people I investigated, he said, it makes sense that the United States would have black people. It makes no sense that Germany would have black people. And that made, particularly the inclusion of black soldiers in German uniforms, that made a lot of people upset. Because that was, for them, proof that this game was not historically accurate, that there were never any black men in German uniforms, and that there are no black people in Germany at this time.
Yeah, one thing I thought was very interesting was that a lot of the kind of claims that try to minimize this kind of depiction of history that you bring up have to do with percentages, like people really obsessing over exactly, like, I could only find 8 records of black German soldiers, and one of them was a musician, so that doesn't count. Like these kinds of attempts to, you know, say, well, you know, maybe they were there, but it's like a tiny percentage, and then they just blew up this whole percentage. Now it's like all of them, and that looks like forced diversity to me. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to say I feel uncomfortable with black people in this game, but you know, these other arguments around it, you know, how are we supposed to even cope with that? Like when we see it in the wild,
it's very strange, right? The numbers game is an incredibly interesting one, because that's one I see recurringly when dealing with video games and representation within video games, because it sort of is, well, how is there a threshold for how people are meant to, before they can be allowed to be represented? And I think for the listener or / the viewer, for them to really understand what we're talking about not a main character here. We're talking about these really anonymous, almost faceless multiplayer characters that you sort of inhabit and display these multiplayer matches. That's as deep as it goes. And people were so visibly upset about that. And the numbers game, again, it's very good that you brought up that entire thing with the numbers and German soldiers. That was one of the very strong reoccurring arguments. And they went even further. They said that there were only 5 of them. 4 of them were musicians. And one of them, we don't even know what they did. That's the argument that they make. And one thing I do in my book is to actually look closer at this argument. Well, first of all, there were more than 5. We know there are more than 5, but there aren't any exact numbers. And that is what these people exploit. They exploit this insecurity amongst historians, because amongst historians, it's obvious that we don't have all the answers. It comes with the game. We don't. And particularly the further back we go, and particularly involving women, minorities, everything you can imagine, people of a specific gender identity, whatever. These are people always invisible lives, in particularly in European countries. I went through these names that they mentioned and realized that these were all men who had fought in German uniform with weapons in their hands, and who had in many times been injured or been awarded medals. The Iron Cross in several cases. These were men who, yes, had been musicians in the pre-war German army, and then, you know, they were soldiers. But these were strategies. These were ways for them to sort of be able to find a way to deny these men a specific place within ideas of authenticity. Because they would always compare them to white men. They would always say, well, the white men, these were the soldiers. These were the ones that died in the largest numbers. These are always quantifiable, always most. And the question there again becomes, well, where do you draw the line? These are all rooted, like, these are all abstract ideas about, well, how many, how many before you can actually be allowed them to cross that threshold and be allowed to represent. And I think that for anyone listening, that those are strategies, tactics that are used to deny people space. There are ways to sort of say that these people shouldn't be allowed to represent Europe, for example, or countries that are seen as predominantly white. And that is obviously very disturbing, because the big issue here is that we continuously see it in our everyday environment, whether we're on Twitter or, sometimes we're in the cinema and we hear something very disturbing, as someone just saying, well, that's so unrealistic. You know, I heard that many, many times since I started studying Battlefield 1 in 2016, because I started at the same time. And whether it was, you know, the depiction of Wakanda in Black Panther, I remember sitting in the cinema here in Sweden and hearing someone behind me say, you know, we're showing the trailer back in 2018, saying, oh, that's so unrealistic. Well, of course it is. It's a sci-fi movie, but that's not what they meant, you know? Right. It was tied to race. It was tied to ideas about how Black people are represented. Go on.
No, I was going to say, this actually leads me to a further question I wanted to push on, which is that, so this idea of authenticity, what's interesting is that it seems like authentic doesn't necessarily mean accurate going the other way as well. So people who were complaining about people of color being represented in these games also had no problem with weapons that were not realistic being part of gameplay. And they would be like, oh, well, that's just to enhance the user experience. That's just what makes it more fun. But this kind of perceived inauthenticity is a problem. So like, how do those things work together? Like, if you're going for a perfectly historically accurate game, why wouldn't you also be mad about the weapons? I just feel like we have to bring that up.
Absolutely. And it's a weird contradiction, right? So in the game, there's only so much historical weapons that you can include. So there are a lot of examples of experimental weapons, sort of models that maybe never even reached the battlefield or that only existed in 20 copies. And yet are widely available in the game because, you know, it's a game. That's, I think we forget about that. A lot of people, it's just a video game. But it's sort of strange that people have no issues about so many silly, goofy things, which is a battlefield game. You can do a lot of really funny, goofy things. Experimental weapons, vehicles that wouldn't have been available in such large quantities, you know, whatever. They exist and they make the game fun. But the presence of people of color, that's the problem for a lot of people. And that's why I propose this theoretical model, the theoretical framework in my book called White Mythic Space. And what that means is that the White Mythic Space, in my view, is a model of authenticity in which people see authenticity, historical accuracy, in the color of one's skin. In particularly, there's a privilege of white skin over brown skin, in which people who are white, who are seen as white or considered white, are seen as, well, that's their natural state. They're obviously meant to exist in the past, but people of color are not. And that is the very ground of this theoretical framework that I propose in the book, which can be used in a lot of different media, books, literature, video games, movies, film, to study the reception of these works, how people receive and how they perceive it. And I often call it a weaponized form of historical memory, because this model of authenticity is not only used to be like, oh, this is fine, this is accurate, this is historically accurate. It is used to hammer down on representations that are seen as inaccurate. Because I think we've all seen a film or we played a game where we're like, this is obviously does not correspond to what it actually was like. Like, this is not actually history. This is kind of silly. anything beyond that. We see it, we see, oh, well, that's kind of silly, and we move on. That's usually how it works. That's usually how people do react to this. But believers, so I'm going to say believers because it is a belief form of it, in the white mystic space, see this and they need to defend it. They need to defend this pre-established image of what the past is. And it is a very extreme, extreme form of historical memory. Because usually historical memory, and this is something I point out in the book, usually historical memory, there are disputes. There are discussions, there are debates. And sometimes one group wins over the other, and this group sort of adds its own elements into it and so forth. They're adjustable. They change over time. The white mystic space doesn't. And that's what makes it so worrying, in my opinion, because it is so, it really closes the rank very, very early. And it is used as a weapon against minorities, essentially.
Interesting. So one thing I thought was very different about your book, and in a good way, was the kinds of sources you chose to engage. So there's absolutely typical sort of academic memory studies and, you know, historical analyses and journal articles. But you also chose to include a lot, I mean, naturally, because of the subject matter, a lot of comments from online forums, from just random commenters who you gave credit and cited, just like anybody else. And I guess one of my questions is, what kind of guidelines went into that for you? How did you choose comments? I think a lot of us think, oh, well, internet discourse isn't to be taken seriously. You know, how did you balance between maybe giving too much credit to some goofball on the internet, right? Mm-hmm. And also using their discourse as a serious thing to discuss.
That's a great question about methodology, because it's very interesting. So digital history, which is what this is, uses what's known in the field as born digital source material, which are essentially everything that's born online. Like this podcast is born online. It's a born digital source, or comment posts or whatever. So I knew I was going to have to draw on something to do this. And I thought, well, the online discourse is going to be the best way to do it. But as you mentioned, I mean, the internet is what it is. It's just filled with this god-awful troll comments everywhere, on Twitter, on YouTube, whatever. So what I first had to do was to be a good historian and go through thousands and thousands of these god-awful discourse about this game. I began with YouTube. I thought, I went through the prism of being a participant, not in the discourse, but through the games. I knew what people reacted to first. And I knew that they first went after the official release trailer, official release announcement of the game, which broke records when it first came out. It was a great success. People were incredibly excited. Because to put it into context at this time, Battlefield was up against Call of Duty, and Call of Duty had chosen a more futuristic take on their first-person shooter. While Battlefield went more historical, people thought, wow, this blows Call of Duty out of the water. So it's a very popular release trailer. And I used digital tools to sort of be able to go back all the way to 2016 and start reading these comments. And I was looking for comments that were, you know, obviously objecting to this representation. Now, in the trailer, there isn't much, there aren't any really depiction of people of color in it, which is interesting. It's only at the end where you get to see the poster of the cover art of the game, where you see the African-American soldier being depicted. And as I reveal in my book, it took only minutes before someone pointed this out in a negative way. And it escalated further down. You know, the more time it passed, the more of these comments existed. And I just took a look at the first day, and then obviously I started looking at it in a larger time frame, because I follow essentially the entire reaction of the game from October 2016. No, actually, you know, way before that, the spring of 2016, all the way through 2017 and beyond, almost in real time, to show how it sort of changes over time. And what the comments I chose were all what I consider representative of the specific discourse surrounding this game. And I obviously think there are troll comments in there. There are people who are being edgy for being edgy sick. There's always going to be there. But when you start seeing a more repeated pattern, when you start seeing people reusing these arguments over and over again, that's when I started choosing some of these comments to sort of represent what people actually did, because not all of them are explicitly racist. There are some that are just downright just white supremacist Nazi discourse, and you know, those are too easy, you know, this is too easy to pick, but there are those that are more genuine that do come off as being, wow, well, this is wrong, why is he here? So YouTube is one thing, but then I chose to sort of expand my horizons because I needed more reactions. I need a broader source base. That I looked at Reddit, first of all, as a huge gaming community who immediately found objection with the game. The official Battlefield 1 subreddit, which is his own subform. But perhaps more importantly to me and to the book was the official Battlefield forums run by Electronic Arts. And I thought, well, if there is a place where you can really capture these deep discussions about this game, it has to be the official board. And I was right. It was a goldmine. I have found thousands upon thousands of pages of people complaining, debating amongst themselves about the accuracy of the game. And I just want to make sure here, because I tried to give them space in the book, but obviously this is more about the reception. There were a lot of people who did come out in defense of the game who tried to argue against these people, unfortunately, obviously, with their own limited historical skills, but they were, you know, they were prudent enough to say, well, come on, it's why they existed. You just go to Wikipedia or whatnot. But again, and there I had to look at representative examples that I introduced in the book. But it was very obvious as to what the line of arguments became after a while. That were much more than just they're people of color, they shouldn't exist, and they're black people, they shouldn't exist in game. They were more specific arguments as the numerical argument, as I call it, the numerical argument. There was only this certain amount of people, they shouldn't. And the thing about it is that once these arguments were introduced, specific arguments related to the First World War in relation to the game, they became reproduced. In my book, I follow the example of a YouTube video in which they pretty much introduced this concept of there were five black Germans in the First World War. They were all musicians. Actually, there weren't any black people in Germany at all, which is a very contradiction that they introduced. This YouTube video today has 500,000 views. The arguments within were reproduced continuously throughout the entire internet, showing the sort of reach of the discourse at the time and how this is used to sort of present an alternative view of history. So these were my primary sources, essentially. These were the sources that I used as a historian, because I work with the source material as a historian. So just as the way as a historical of the 19th century would use newspapers, which includes a lot of anonymous opinion pieces, articles, everything to sort of gauge things. I use the Wide World Web to sort of scour for all of these comments, internet, from YouTube videos to YouTube comments to board comments. And if I may sort of finish up real quick, the official Battlefield 1 forum does no longer exist. It was, I had just finished the manuscript of the book, and a month later, I think it was in April of 2021, something, they actually shut down the entire official EA forums. Everything there is gone. Not archived, it vanished. Oh, and wow. That again shows the the sensitivity of born digital source material where it can just be removed in one go, thousands upon thousands of pages of these discussions that could have been helpful for historians and other researchers, that's just gone in one instant. So for the most part, what you see in my book, in which I quote without any modification of these citation, these quotes, those are the only things that still exist. You can't repeat this study, which is the unfortunate part. You can't, it can't be done again, because all of these comments, they're gone. They don't no longer exist. Some of them are, these threads are archived on the Internet Archive. So please, you know, you can go in, because I do have the complete URL. You can go and try and see if you can find them. Some you can. But for the most part, the stuff that's in my book, that's the last of it.
Wow. So that's crazy. And digital history scares me for this reason. But I also want to kind of look at this from a different angle as well. So, you know, we mentioned before I officially started recording that, you know, you had teachers in Sweden who, you know, didn't bother to learn your name correctly. And, you know, there are representation and social issues in Sweden, as there are throughout the United States, throughout Europe. But one thing that I thought was quite interesting was that there's also a separate discourse kind of blaming the representation in the game on the liberalism of Sweden and Swedish ideological positions. Mm-hmm. And so how did that play to you as somebody who actually lives in Sweden and grew up there, and, you know, to see that as part of the discourse? Like, why is that there and how accurate is that?
Swedes don't like to hear that they're xenophobic or, you know, intolerant or racist. That's incredibly still controversial, because this idea of brown people existing in the Swedish past is as controversial as it is in my book amongst, you know, where Swedes, which have existed since before the 17th century, you know, are only recently becoming acknowledged. I wrote a little article about we see that with the reaction to Frozen 2, where they have a man of African descent, Lieutenant Matthias, in the film, and people were like, they're no black people in Scandinavia in the 19th century when Frozen ostensibly takes place. I mean, completely disregarding the Ice Queen, by the way, just completely disregarding the magical stuff and talking trolls. It is a black person who shouldn't be there. And I got interested in that when I started seeing that. I started doing my own research on Afro-Swedes, and I essentially found my own, like one of my own personal favorites, which is a man called John Pansy Toxon, who just arrived in Gothenburg in the mid 19th century. We don't know. There's so many lurid stories about how he ended up there. Started out as a gardener and ended up being the sort of personal assistant to the Swedish king in the late 19th century, and sort of became the most famous black man in Sweden in the late 19th century, where he was continuously sort of referenced in newspapers and travel diaries and journals, and was obviously an incredibly intelligent man who spoke several European languages. Incredibly fascinating life story, but only one of several. And there are two visions of Sweden in the discourse that I speak about in the book. One of which is this view of a fallen state, a fallen liberal state in which Sweden just is in very far right discourse sort of invaded by hordes of brown people and so on. And you have to understand this context within historical context, which is obviously the year 2015 through 2018. This is just after the refugee crisis in the Middle East. Europe received waves of millions and millions of refugees, and this made the discussions about immigration very, 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 very pertinent in European political discussions and in mass media and stuff like that, which still affects Swedish society today, and the sort of political decisions taken even by leftist parties. So they present Sweden as this fallen utopia, this invaded sort of fallen state, which is was at the time and still is very, very common within far-right circles. And that sort of puts us in the mindset of the time, which, you know, still exists today. It's not, and, you know, we might not think of 2016 as history, but it is. And, you know, this was the time of Trump. This was the time of a rise in the alt-right and the far-right across the world. So as a historian, I see it within that context. You know, I don't take it personally. We've always been made fun of online. So, you know, but it does work within a very specific social context, which interestingly filtered down to cultural productions, and particularly video game. This was obviously the era of Gamergate. This was the era in which the inclusion of not only people of color, but also women was highly, highly, highly criticized by a predominantly masculine gamers online, where this discourse was incredibly toxic and very vicious. And I do explore that in my book. So these arguments against the people of color don't exist in a vacuum. They do exist in a very societal context, which saw a rise in xenophobia, misogyny, racism, and so on. Now, as someone who grew up as Latino in Sweden, my parents were refugees from Chile. I see myself more in that denial of representation and agency that they extend to Black Germans, for example, Afro Germans, because one of the most unknown, and I think anyone who comes from a foreign background here, one of the most annoying questions that we usually get is, oh, where are you from? And then they have to insist, well, where are you really from? You know, when I tell them that I'm born in Sweden, they're like, oh yeah, where are your parents from? Where are you really from? And that sort of micro sort of racist experience that we have to, where we have to justify why we are here. Why we're even in a country as liberal as Sweden. Sweden is, I mean, in comparison to other countries, it is a very liberal country. But even here, I have to justify why I'm here, you know, how I ended up here. And I can't imagine how it is for, I mean, Afro-Swedes suffer tremendously of this, and Afro-Germans too, you know, and so on and so forth. And that is sort of the real life consequences I speak about this idea of denial of representation, in which people, and in particular these comments, the people who write these comments, have a racialized notion of national identity, in which it is you can't be Black and German. It just, you can't. You can't be Black and Swedish. You can't be Black and Finnish, so on and so forth. It doesn't exist within their worldview. And it particularly not in the past. And although I don't really mention it in the book, I you know, I've been thinking about it more and more lately. And I think that historical memory is used to provide legitimacy. We have a continuation. We have a past, a shared past. And if you don't think that there can be people of color in Europe today that who are born and raised, and who sometimes is third, fourth generation even, if that is something that is so against you, then you obviously don't want to grant historical legitimacy in the past, that they've always been here, that there's always been Black people in Europe, and that this is sometimes often tied to very, very painful histories of colonialism, of imperialism, of transatlantic slavery. And that is something that has been, you know, more and more relevant since 2015, obviously, first with the protests against statues in South Africa and the United States, And then through, obviously, the explosive in 2020, in the spring of 2020, in which all of these representations of what essentially is seen as unjust history, of tragic history, of this history that is racist, it has put the history of marginalized people back on the table of historical memory. And the history of Battlefield 1 and the reaction to it is part of that movement, of a counter movement to that desire to be represented.
So this kind of leads me to another question, which is, it seems to me that white mythic space and then other sorts of historical memory are not necessarily fully conscious. They're instinctive. They are emotional. They are personal. So how do you catch yourself participating in or holding historical memories that are harmful? And how do you confront that in yourself and also in others? Like, what can we do to kind of break up mythic spaces and and change historical memory?
I think that's a very, very important question to ask, because on the one hand, you have people who don't want to change, people who have this so ingrained in them that they can't imagine. And that's when you've fallen into the white mystic space, where this is so ingrained and the only response you have is to defend it. It is to find ways to defeat your so-called opponent. It becomes almost, again, becomes weaponized. In general, I believe that one way is to familiarize yourself with the topic of historical memory. Just understand what it is, that it is a representation of the past. It's not history and so forth and so on. And I think that one way is to just question things in a healthy manner, in which you do listen to what people say and wonder, well, could this really be it? And actually be open to be wrong, to be open for new histories, and to particularly listen to those who have a history to share, which might be completely new or incredible to you, but don't dismiss it out of hand. Now, as a historian, I would always say, be skeptic, read your sources, understand, different interpretations of the past, obviously. But there are some truths, there are some historical facts that you can't change them. There were people of color in the past. That's, you can't dispute that. And I feel like educating yourself is a very good thing. Not jumping to conclusions is another thing immediately. But more importantly, is also to understand how these people work. The people who believe in the white mystic space, how do their arguments look like? Because I have seen these being reproduced continuously over so many different subjects and so different media that it's not only limited to this video game, to this specific game, to this specific media. So you have the arguments, you have an openness to history, to wanting to learn more and to fact check. But I also believe that you have to, and this is not something that you as a private individual can, this is more institutional, where there has to be a larger change that the people who produce games, who write them, who do them, everything, there has to be more openness for people of color to work behind the scenes, to create more inclusive stories, and who can recognize and point out depictions that might be damaging or contradictory to what the game makers want to do. Because the Battlefield 1 has great depictions of people of color. I'm not gonna lie, but there is also a lot of stuff where I, a historian or someone else who is more versed in African American history, for example, would be able to point out that some of these are not good and they can be damaging and that they're not that good. So I think there are two levels here, just the personal level, this institutional level, in which we can both work towards sort of breaking that white mystic space, which is mostly based on education and a willingness to not fall into the easy way, to just say that these people don't belong here.
Yeah. I also think that what you're saying, as somebody who's post-ac, right, and you're still in academia, mm-hmm. You know, we often think of academic history as something that's sort of sealed off. It's off in the ivory tower. There are people like up there who are doing the work. But I kind of feel like it is important actually to be engaging with online discourse about history and to be a professional on the scene offering expertise about it. Because if you're not there, somebody on YouTube is.
Exactly. And that's why I chose to write this book as accessible as possible, so that high school students would be able to pick up this book and learn from it. It includes an entire chapter on historical memory where I just introduce the concept, and it is written in the most accessible way possible, because having been a student and now obviously both a PhD student and a researcher, I have read countless of theoretical works on historical memory, and even books that are aimed at undergrads are incredibly complicated because they're full of jargon, they're full of theoretical considerations. They're not accessible. And I wanted to make historical memory accessible for everyone. And as you mentioned, it is important for not only academics, but for everyone to educate and to spread that knowledge online through all variety of means. So not only, you know, fighting trolls on Twitter, but YouTube, podcasts, blogs, right? Whatever you want to do, do it. But, you know, but present a history that doesn't exclude. And I think that's the most important part, that doesn't exclude, that allows these people, these real life people who once lived among us to become alive again.
Yes, do history responsibly, folks. So, Stefan, I'm going to ask you a couple softies just at the end of the interview. One, what are you playing for fun right now? Since if you're writing about games, I know you're a gamer. So,
yes. I am playing Civilization on my Switch.
Fantastic.
I love Civilization. It's just you know, just to shut your head off for a moment and play a little, you know, when you can on a portable Switch.
Beautiful. And if people want to follow your work or find you online, where can you be found?
Well, you can easily, for those who are interested in more of the academia side of things, you can just Google my name, Stefan Aguirre Quiroga. You just honestly just copy and paste it from wherever you can find it. And you'll find my institutional page. You'll find my research gate, my academia.edu. You'll find my Google Scholar. That's where you'll find my academic work. But if you just want to chat, if you just want to keep in touch, you just want to talk about how much you love my book, you know, the usual stuff. At Railock on Twitter is where you'll find me. So at R-A-I-L-O-K at Gmail, at Twitter. That's a great place. That is my old username from when I was 12 and play video games online, and I've just never changed it.
Perfect. So all that'll be in the show notes, everybody. Hopefully you know that I can be found anywhere as Beyond Solitaire. But Stefan, thank you so much for coming on. It's been such a lovely conversation. I really appreciate your book. And everybody out there, please like, comment, subscribe, ask questions. And most of all, happy gaming.